Now, if you woke up this morning looking at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, if you were on the Illinois side, you might have seen something that, well, gave you a sense of nostalgia. There on the front page was the headline, Illinois House Votes to Ratify ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment. Now, I remember, this is going to date me a bit, I remember when I was a little kid seeing the signs ERA and asking my mother, what is that? And she said, it's the Equal Rights Amendment, it's women's liberation. And I didn't understand any of that. I grew up and I learned about the Equal Rights Amendment, and I learned that it was history. Even by the time I was a little kid, history. Well, what is the Illinois House doing ratifying it, since it's been dead for 2 decades at least? We'll talk about that in the first half hour of Issues Etc. today with Phyllis Schlafly. She's president of Eagle Forum. She'll join us here in just a moment. After we're done talking with Phyllis, we're going to have open lines for your questions and your comments. Has the United States become a Judeo-Christian Islamic nation? There are Muslim groups and some other groups that are calling for a change. No longer Judeo-Christian values, no longer Judeo-Christian heritage. How about Judeo-Christian Islamic values, Judeo-Christian Islamic heritage? And some say, look, that's too cumbersome. Let's just call it Abrahamic. We'll talk about that during open lines. And the Unitarian Universalist leader, the leader of that, should I call it a church? A denomination? I don't know what to call it, because they deny the existence of God. He wants to talk more about God, and he's meeting some resistance. Just at the same time that there are many Christian groups who are saying we need to talk less about God. This is interesting. And you'll be interested to note that both the Christians who are saying we should talk less about God, or be less specific about God, and the Unitarian Universalists who think they need to be more specific, are doing it for the same reasons. That'll be open lines. Following open lines, we'll be talking with Dr. Gene Edward Veith, author of our Issues Etc. book of the month for May called The Spirituality of the Cross, about how it is a Christian lives with one foot in God's secular kingdom and one foot in God's sacred kingdom. We'll talk about that then. And in the final hour of the program, Gretchen Pasentino of Answers in Action joins us. We'll be talking with her about God as mother. No, we will not be giving in to feminism. But there are passages in Scripture that compare God to a mother, and we'll find out what it is they teach. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin. Phyllis Schlafly joins us, president of Eagle Forum and author of the book. I'll tell you a little bit about it later. Feminist Fantasies. Phyllis, welcome back to Issues
Etc. Hello, Todd. Good to join you.
Phyllis, what in the world happened in the Illinois House with the Equal Rights Amendment?
Well, a lot of new people have taken over, and they don't remember the past. They don't have any historical memory, and they wanted to have a political game, a political ploy, of having a roll call vote on the Equal Rights Amendment so they can do some posturing and claim they're for women, when they really are, what they're doing is tossing a bouquet to the radical feminists. The Equal Rights Amendment, as you said earlier, died in 1982. The Supreme Court declared it dead. They said it was moot. It was over. And they are trying to pretend that it's still around and vote it, and they're playing games with the Constitution. They're trying to use a crooked path, and anybody who follows a crooked path is not going to be able to achieve fairness and equity. Now, for those who went on record as supporting and voting for this resolution, they have put themselves on record for abortion funding by the taxpayers, for same-sex marriages, for sending women into direct military combat, and for giving more power to the federal government, because that's what ERA would do if it is ever ratified.
Now, you've been following the Equal Rights Amendment for its entire history. Give us an historical perspective on this attempted constitutional amendment.
The Equal Rights Amendment is a proposed amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which was voted out by Congress in 1972. In order to become part of the Constitution, you have to have it ratified by three-fourths, that's 38 states. They had 10 years to do it, and at their peak, they got 35 states, but five of those states changed their minds and rescinded. So their 10-year effort ended up with just 30 states. Now, among those that did not ratify it were Illinois and Missouri. And the radical feminists, whose purpose is always tax-funded abortions and same-sex marriage licenses, in fact, the whole gay agenda, are trying to breathe new life in it. And they think if they can get a house, the legislature, to pass a resolution for it, they can bring it back to life and somehow move it along what I think is a very dishonest path toward ratification.
Representative Lou Lang, a Democrat from Skokie, Illinois, said that, or has argued, that Congress could retroactively extend the deadline for the ERA that passed 21 years ago. What do you think of that?
Well, I think it's dishonest, and I don't think it's true, and I think anybody who is trying to go that path is really doing something that is dishonest with the Constitution. So it's hard to say you're trying to achieve fairness and equity when you're doing something that's wrong or dishonest. You see, when the Equal Rights Amendment came out of Congress, it said that it would be part of the Constitution if it were ratified within 7 years. As they approached the end of the 7 years and didn't get it, Congress did pass an extension of another 3 years, which I feel, and many, most people felt, was like giving three more innings to a baseball game that was not tied up. But at any rate, they fought it for three more years, and they didn't get another single state, because most people thought that was dishonest. Now they want to come along after the whole thing is dead and the Supreme Court has declared it dead, and think that if they get three more states, they can declare it in the Constitution. And I think they're making fools of themselves. But it's important to note that those who voted for it are putting themselves on record as supporting the agenda of the feminists, which is taxpayer-funded abortions, the whole gay rights agenda, same-sex marriage licenses, women in direct military combat, continuing to use Title IX to abolish men's sports, and giving a whole bunch of new powers to the federal government, including all laws that make any kind of difference or mention of men and women, such as marriage, divorce, marriage property laws, adoptions, abortion, schools, colleges, insurance, prison regulations.
Have the feminists, the radical feminists, been able to achieve gradually in the last 30 years through the legislature and through the judiciary what the ERA was attempting to do in one fell swoop? Have they been able to do it anyway, even without the ERA?
They've been able to do some things, but they haven't gotten their same-sex marriages. And even the Roe versus Wade court has not held that you have a constitutional right to have your abortion paid for. So those are the two things that they're really pushing for, and they have not gotten those. Now, they have, to a large degree, feminized the military with a lot of double standards, but they still don't have women in direct military combat, and which is what they want. And so I would say it's terribly important that we keep the Equal Rights Amendment defeated, because the extremism of the amendment is not something that the American people want.
You said that at its peak it got 35 states to ratify it. How was that achieved if, in fact, the American people are not in favor of most of what the ERA calls for? How did they get 35?
Well, I'll tell you the reasons. First of all, they got 30 states in the first 12 months, and many of those without any hearing or debate. It had such momentum. It had a good name. It had all the powers that be for it. All the presidents of the United States were for it. Nixon and Ford and Carter. All the governors were for it. All the men in positions of power were for it. All the media, 99% of the media. And it was a constant din. Also, they had the nice-sounding name. It's equal rights. It sounds good, doesn't it? But when you get down to what it really means, if you put it in the Constitution, that's another matter. So when we persuaded the state legislatures to hold hearings, and they were willing to listen to both sides, that's when they voted it down. But the head start that the ERAers had of 30 states was a tremendous stumbling block. And we didn't go back to those states, most of them. Five of them rescinded. But for the most part, the battles were waged in the states that had never rescinded, never ratified.
I mentioned at the outset there, Phyllis, that, you know, I remember as a little kid seeing the signs for, you know, the ones that read, the round signs that read ERA and those things, and wondering what it was. I am on the very trailing edge of the baby boom generation, and those who are calling for this were on the leading edge of the baby boom generation. Is this a baby boom thing? Is this really just baby boomers who have made it into the Illinois House and are nostalgic for the heady days of the 70s?
Well, I'm sure there's some of that, but the real thing that happened in Illinois was the Democrats took over everything. And if you've noticed, the radical feminists have a death grip around the top levels of the Democratic Party. Everybody who's running for president in the Democratic Party has to pledge himself to support the feminist and the gay rights agenda. And they all support Roe versus Wade. And so when the Democrats took over everything, both the governor of Illinois and both houses of the legislature, they do this as a diversionary thing. They want to do some kind of payoff to the radical feminists who are supporting them. And even though some of them may think it's just symbolic. And that's what happened in Illinois. Of course, that's not going to happen in Missouri at all. It's impossible to happen in Missouri.
Why is that?
Well, for one thing, the Republicans have taken over the legislature. But the enormous dominance of the liberal Democrats and the feminists in the Democratic Party in Illinois is a consequence of the last election. It really was a consequence of a corrupt Republican administration that preceded it, and the voters showed their anger by turning all the Republicans out. Now ERA is not really a Republican-Democratic issue. It's just that this heavy majority of new Democrats in the legislature want to toss a bouquet to the radical feminists, who are a major part of their political constituency.
Now, you have mentioned the...
We've got a lot of good Democrats who are opposing ERA and always have had. It's not a party issue, except that the fact that so many liberal Democrats took over in Illinois in this last election, that they want to show the radical feminists that they will go along with them.
Phyllis Lafley is our guest. She's president of Eagle Forum, and we're talking about yesterday's vote in the Illinois House to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. She's author of a new book. It's called Feminist Fantasies, and if you read Feminist Fantasies, folks, you're going to learn an awful lot about the Equal Rights Amendment, because it follows many of the things that Phyllis has written over the years in response to not only the Equal Rights Amendment itself, but to the issues that surround it as well. The book is called Feminist Fantasies, and you can purchase it by calling Spence Publishing toll-free at 1-888-SPEN-PUB. That's 1-888-SPENPUB, or you can order Feminist Fantasies online by going to Spence's website, which is SpencePublishing.com. SpencePublishing.com. The phone number again, 1-888-SPENPUB, SPEN-PUB. Phyllis, you mentioned the strong influence that radical feminism has in the Democratic Party. Do you detect a similar growing influence of radical feminism in the Republican Party as well?
No, I don't. I don't think it's there. I think the radical feminists, who are basically a small group, but they have powerful positions in the media and in the colleges. And I think they have cast their lot with the Democratic Party. You noticed on the anniversary of Roe versus Wade, when every Democratic candidate, I think, aren't there about 10 of them? Everyone showed up at that anniversary dinner to pledge his support to Roe versus Wade, that is, to killing unborn babies. And you notice how every man who runs for president on the Democratic ticket has to switch to pro-abortion. And that is true of Bill Clinton, Dick Gephardt, Al Gore and Jesse Jackson. They all started out pro-life, but when they got the presidential bug, they switched to pro-abortion. And that is because of the political power of part of their constituency, which are these radical feminists.
What does the passage, albeit very belated passage of or ratification of the ERA in the Illinois House, what does it say about feminism in general, not just its influence, but I'm thinking of the question, do they have any new ideas? It's been 30 years.
Yes. No, they don't have any new ideas. They have the same old fantasies that they had 30 years ago, and that's why your listeners would do well to read my book, Feminist Fantasies, because they are saying the same thing. They're still trying to get women in these combat jobs in the military. They're still trying to pretend they are victims of an oppressive male-dominated society. They're still trying to tell young women that the greatest fulfillment for women is in the workforce, not in building a family and having a happy marriage and raising your children. They're still trying to tell young women, selfishly seek your own fulfillment over every other goal. And I guess the bottom line of their ideology is that God goofed in making us of two different kinds, and they're trying to get the Constitution and legislation to remedy his mistake, or should I say her mistake. That's the way they look about it. So the Equal Rights Amendment is the centerpiece of the goals that they want. They want to forbid us to make any reasonable difference of treatment between men and women. They want to forbid us from saying that there are some jobs in the military women do admirably and very well, and there are other jobs that men do admirably and very well.
You know, that makes me wonder. You say they, and I agree with you, that they are still under the same fantasies they had 30 years ago. Has feminism become more radical or less radical in its short history?
I think it's exactly the same. I think they're all peddling the same line. Now, they have softened a few of the edges. For example, when they started out, they called themselves the Women's Liberation Movement, till we showed that what they meant by liberation was liberation from home, husband, family, and children. And so now they prefer the word feminist. But even so, the majority of American women do not want to be called feminist, because they correctly say that it is a radical group and with heavy doses of lesbianism.
Is radical feminism here to stay? Will it pass the way of the dinosaur when the bright lights that have been around for 30 years are gone?
Well, they're not having any children. I mean, the St. Louis Post ran a big spread a few weeks ago on some aging members of the National Organization for Women, and they're sitting there looking at their scrapbook with pictures of Betty Friedan. Now, when I look at my scrapbook, I see pictures of 14 beautiful grandchildren. And most of the women I've debated don't have children or grandchildren. And however, they have lodged themselves in the media. Bernard Goldberg describes that in his new best-selling book, Bias, so the enormous power that they wield in the media, so that even tough old Sam Donaldson kind of gets weak-kneed when he's confronted by these feminists. And they are very powerful in the universities. If you hear talk about political correctness and you try to find out what political correctness is, feminism is the centerpiece of that. And so they're trying to train a new generation. And then their number one feminist, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, is on the U.S. Supreme Court. So they're out there, and they have positions of power, even though, as a movement, I believe they're very much discredited by the way they stood by Bill Clinton during the days of his dreadful behavior toward women.
Have we been witnessing the institutionalization of feminism?
In some areas, that's maybe what the women's studies courses are for. However, there's a new report out that if you major in women's studies, you're going to have a hard time getting a job. You could go to work for now, but that's about it.
Isn't that ironic, Phyllis, that feminism said, get out of the house, forget the kids and the husband, go get a job. Oh, by the way, maybe the best way to do that would be to take some women's studies courses at your local university, but you're unemployable when you get out.
Yeah. And then also, when you teach women that they're victims, they face life with a chip on their shoulder. And you really, If you imagine the psychology of some of these people who think that passing this bill in the Illinois legislature, which really has no legal effect, because it wouldn't have a legal effect unless it got ratified by 38 states, and yet that's going to help them solve their personal problems. It's kind of a psychological thing with them. And it's too bad, and it's too bad for the men to fall for that and to go along with it in giving them the symbolism of it. And I would say that everybody who voted yesterday in the Illinois House for the Equal Rights Amendment is putting himself on record for same-sex marriages, taxpayer-funded abortions, putting women in direct military combat, and transferring enormous powers to the federal government.
Okay, two quick final questions. First of all, why don't we need the ERA? Why don't we need it?
Well, it's based on the false premise that women are victims and mistreated, whereas the American woman is the most fortunate class of people who ever lived. It's based on the false premise that there are no differences between men and women, and that we must always, in everything, treat them exactly alike. And that's ridiculous. God made men and women differently, and we're entitled to respect those differences. If you don't respect those differences, the big loser is the baby. Because while the feminist movement has changed a lot of women's attitudes and some men's attitudes, it hasn't changed babies' attitudes at all. I've noticed they have exactly the same attitudes that they had 30 years ago. And, of course, in the feminist view, it's so oppressive for mothers to be expected to take care of their babies. And we want to relieve that by having government daycare for all children.
We've only got about 30 seconds here, and I still want to mention your book one more time. Even if other states joined Illinois and ratified up to the level of 38 now, would that make any progress for the ERA?
I don't think it would, because they're out of time. The game's over. It's like going back to your high school reunion and trying to play the last quarter of the football game. They're just out of the game, and it's really just symbolic. But it's just very sad that a lot of men in the legislature fell for this symbolism and unfortunately put themselves on the side of the radical feminists and the gay rights lobby.
Phyllis Schlafly, thank you for being our guest on Issues Etc.
And I hope your listeners will read Feminist Fantasies.
Phyllis Schlafly is president of Eagle Forum. The book she has just written is called, she's been writing this for 30 years, and it's been put together in a way that will teach you a lot about the Equal Rights Amendment, its history, but also about the issues that are still with us, even if the ERA is dead and gone. The book is called Feminist Fantasies. Get it from the publisher, Spence Publishing, at 1-888-SPENPUB, S-P-E-N-P-U-B, or online, ask for Feminist Fantasies, SpencePublishing.com, SpencePublishing.com, or 1-888-SPENPUB, SPENPUB. When we come back from this break, we've got open lines for your questions and your comments. We'll talk a little bit about the United States being a Judeo-Christian Islamic nation. Stay with us.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If Christian doctrine can be true or false, can Christian practice also be true or false? Is Christian practice always neutral? What's the relationship between Christian doctrine and Christian practice? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. You'll find answers to these questions in the latest edition of the Issues Etc. Journal. I've written an article titled Doctrine and Practice, and you can receive a complimentary copy of the Issues Etc. Journal by calling our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. I've also written an article on the Lord's Supper titled Responding to Real Absence Arguments. Plus, you'll find a list of tape and book resources on issues such as American evangelicalism, church history, biblical interpretation, and much more. Ask to receive a complimentary copy of the Issues Etc. Journal, 1-800-737-0172.
Now this Global Minute lets you hear a creative tactic to try and get a new Christian to renounce his faith. This brief story took place in the Muslim world, in a country and region that can't be identified. A reputable Christian ministry to Muslims released the report among their prayer partners. A Muslim man who became a Christian is now called a Muslim background believer. He was offered financial help if he wrote a book renouncing Christ. The prayer is that he will find honest work quickly so that the temptation to renounce his faith will fade away. This shows the dilemma that new Christians face in many Muslim countries. There's tremendous pressure to never change your religious system. It takes great courage for many Muslims to say they believe in Jesus Christ as their Savior instead of their own works. Pray for Christians in the Muslim world to remain strong in their faith. Encourage others to pray for the world by logging on to missionvisionnetwork.org and visiting the Encouragement Center.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. I'm eager to see how this one turns out. Annika Sorenstam plays golf today with the men of the PGA. Another installment in society's confusion about the relation of the sexes. When the topic is men and women, someone is sure to put the Bible down for teaching that women are inferior. But it's not true. The Gospel of Thomas, a book written in the style of the biblical Gospels, didn't make the cut when the church decided what books to include in the Bible. One reason was the Gospel of Thomas taught that a good woman might be given a soul when she gets to heaven. On the other hand, 1 Peter did make the cut. It describes believing women as co-heirs of the grace of life, 1 Peter 3, verse 7. A classic chapter is Proverbs 31. The woman it describes is no veiled wallflower. The Bible says much more, and especially about the relations of husbands and wives, but inequality is not taught. I wish Annika Sorenstam well, and I'll listen with great interest as the pundits try to figure out what our Creator has already told us.
Hello, this is Kay Meyer of Family Shield. How does Soaring Spirit Ministries work with prison inmates? Why is music and prayer so important to their work? Join us next time as the co-directors, an ex-offender and his wife, and a former prison chaplain tell us how Soaring Spirit Ministries is touching lives with the gospel.
Family Shield, Saturday mornings at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. The next hour is open lines for your questions and your comments. Just got finished talking with Phyllis Schlafly about, you know, I just had to chuckle when I saw the story. When you think something couldn't come back, it comes back. The Equal Rights Amendment. And there in Illinois, my adopted home state, they've decided, at least the House has decided, that they want to ratify it, even though the Supreme Court has put it down. Even though it's been 21 years, I guess none of those things really make a big difference. Oh, this will interest you. I got this from the Dallas Morning News. It's from the Newhouse News Service, by the way. And the headline caught my eye, "Has the United States become Judeo-Christian Islamic?" All those are hyphenated. Judeo-Christian Islamic. You're familiar, of course, with, you know, common references that America has a Judeo-Christian heritage, or America has a Judeo-Christian ethic. We use this phrase quite a bit here on Issues, Etc. There are those inside and outside American Islam who are saying, look, let's be fair and be honest and say that America is now Judeo-Christian Islamic. I'll read a bit of the story for you in a few minutes. It's open lines, 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. Also, Unitarian leader urges church to recover language of faith. Now, you know about the Unitarian Universalists. It's a merger of two, and I'll use this term advisedly, two denominations, which back in 1961 came together, the Unitarians and the Universalists, the Unitarians denying that God is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and the universalist saying, well, it doesn't really make any difference because everyone's going to heaven anyway, if there is a heaven, if there is a God. They came together to form the Unitarian Universalist. I'm searching for a word. Is it church? Denomination? They call themselves the Unitarian Universalist Association. That's pretty neutral. Well, the president of the nation's most liberal denomination has touched off a theological firestorm, suggesting, this comes from the Religion News Service, by the way, suggesting that the Unitarian Universalist Association needs to reclaim, quote, a vocabulary of reverence by not being afraid to talk about God. The Reverend William Sinkford, in a series of sermons and articles in the last 5 months, said that the creedless denomination needs to re-examine its beliefs because its principles contain no hint of the holy. I'm not suggesting that Unitarian Universalism return to traditional Christian language, Sinkford said in a January opening of a volley at a Fort Worth, Texas church, but I do feel that we need some language that would allow us to capture the possibility of reverence, to name the holy, to talk about human agency in theological terms. Now, Sinkford's call has worried some atheists and humanists who fear that the tradition may no longer have room for the liberal theology that has been its hallmark for 250 years. Last month, in an article in the church's UU World magazine, Sinkford responded, writing, "Many of you, I know, are bothered by the use of the word God." He cautioned, however, that religious language doesn't have to mean God talk. That probably explains why he says we need to learn how to talk about human agency in theological terms. Now think about that for a moment. Theological terms are terms that, at least by definition, the common definition, refer to God. But he says we need to talk about human agency in theological terms. We need to talk about human beings in divine terms. I don't know if that's what he means or if this is just, you know, this is a denomination, association, church, whatever you want to call it, that has built itself upon ambiguity and doublespeak. So we shouldn't be surprised by this. What surprises me, however, this doesn't surprise me. What? The Unitarian Universalist would like to talk a little bit more about God. Why? Because otherwise they're irrelevant. They do still consider themselves something of a religion, although they also welcome atheists and agnostics with open arms. The Boston-based church now blends elements of Buddhism, earth-centered and native religions, and scientific rationalism. Now, 2 years ago, dissidents from the group formed the American Unitarian Conference after they said the church had been overtaken by liberal politics. The group's president, Virginia attorney David Burton, says, "I'm not sure if he, that is Sinkford, is talking about language without substance. Language without substance is vacuous," he said. Rhoda Miller, who's a church member from Concord, Massachusetts, told the New York Times that Sinkford's remarks made her feel, listen to this, folks, made her feel that atheists are less welcome in the Unitarian Universalist Association. That's a shame. The Reverend Sidney Wild, pastor of the Unitarian Universalist Church in Reston, Virginia, said that she is not opposed to the discussion of God, but she wants to see more of it grow out of the pews with enough room for diversity. "It's the definition of God that concerns me," she said. She's a self-described mystical humanist, by the way. "I have no difficulty with that word, that is God, but I want a broad enough definition that includes all of us." The Reverend Scott Wells, he's a pastor of Universalist National Memorial Church in Washington, said this. Now listen very carefully. "For us to be more effective in religious discourse, we have to be comfortable with people for whom religious language is where they live." He says, Without religious language, it is impossible to be a religious voice. And I quote, if we are not willing to step up to the ecumenical and interfaith table, then we will find ourselves increasingly marginalized and go the way of the Shakers. One more time, listen. This is a Unitarian Universalist pastor, and he thinks it's probably a good idea to start using religious language again, talking about God, as long as he isn't defined. And his reasoning is, listen again, if we're not willing to step up to the ecumenical and interfaith table, then we will find ourselves increasingly marginalized and go the way of the Shakers. This sounds exactly like what some people are saying in the church. In fact, I probably wouldn't have much difficulty with a simple search engine in finding people of Protestant denominations saying, essentially, if we're not able to step up to the interfaith table, we're going to find ourselves marginalized and go the way of the Shakers. Right now, my church body, the one I'm a member of, is struggling with this very question. There are some voices who are saying, look, if we, in the words of the Unitarian Universalist, if we don't step up to the interfaith table, we will be irrelevant. If we don't step up to the interfaith table, we will find ourselves marginalized. Do we want to be like the Shakers or the Mennonites? The interesting thing here, to me, while Christians are saying we need to sound more like the world, it's the Unitarian Universalists who are saying they should sound less like the world. Is there something wrong with this picture? Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Jim is on the line. Jim, welcome to Issues, Etc.
I don't know. This is, the whole issue is unbelievably complex and unbelievably powerful and fundamental. I would think that they are at best a philosophy. But I have a couple other questions, if you know off the top of your head.
Mm-hmm.
In the Roman Catholic Church, they wrote an encyclical back at the turn of the last century on modernism, and they were very afraid that their own people, from high up down to the pew, were actually atheists, that they had no belief of a God outside of the human being and nothing above humans. Wouldn't they be in the same category, that they don't actually believe that there is a God, and that if there is some type of God, it's more or less our own creation deep, deep, deep down inside us? Am I making any sense, Pastor?
Yeah, Jim, let me respond if I could. Thank you for the call. Well, first of all, I think he's right in calling the Unitarian Universalists nothing more than a philosophy, and I don't think they would call themselves anything more than that either. Why in the world would you, if you built an association, the Unitarian Universalist Association, for 250 years, these two divergent groups came together and formed this thing in 1961, but for 250 years, your basic philosophy has been the God of the Christian scriptures is not the true God. If there is a God, there's no such thing as hell. Everyone's going to heaven. That's all the more you can say. And the if at the beginning of that sentence is written in giant red, bold capital letters. It is an association, a philosophy of if there is a God. Why would you want to, this late in the game, it's 2003 for heaven's sakes, start talking about God again? Now they've told us why. They believe they're being left out of the religious conversation, because they're unable to carry on a religious conversation because God is not in their vocabulary. How can you step up to the interfaith table, that is, the, I would say, the interreligious table, when everyone there has the vocabulary of God, all differently defined, I would remind you, when you don't have the word God in your vocabulary? How do you have a conversation there? So this is logical. The Unitarian Universalists say, look, we want to be included in the religious conversation, so we need to start using more religious language. At the same time, Christians, oddly, are saying, we want to be included in the same conversation, so we need to be more ambiguous about who God is. Yeah, I mean, we do need to preach the gospel and talk about Jesus every once in a while. But, you know, sometimes at that when you sit at that interreligious table, you need to tone it down. Maybe they'll meet someplace in the middle, the Unitarian Universalists and these Christians who are calling for us to both meet at the interreligious table. Maybe if the Christians tone down their God talk and the Universalists ramp it up, they'll meet someplace in the middle. It won't be the Christian faith, though. I can guarantee you that. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Now, he asked the question about the concern that was expressed in Roman Catholic circles several decades ago about whether or not people sitting in the pews are atheists. I don't know. I'll tell you this much, if no matter what you call yourself, if you're an atheist, you would be more at home in the Unitarian Universalist Church, as long as you're willing to put up with minimal God talk. Has the United States become, well, we've always thought of it, or at least for the last 50 years, actually, we've thought of it as a Judeo-Christian nation. Some people argue that it's a Christian nation, and other people say, no, we're really talking about kind of a cultural heritage, a heritage of values. It's a Judeo-Christian heritage, Judeo-Christian values, Judeo-Christian sensibilities. We commonly hear this, even though the term Judeo-Christian was coined only about a half century ago. Americans should stop using the phrase Judeo-Christian to describe the values and character that defines the United States, say, leading Muslim organizations. Better choices, they say, are, here are the two alternatives being proposed, Judeo-Christian Islamic or simply Abrahamic, referring to the biblical patriarch that the three monotheistic religions hail. The new language should be used, quote, in all venues where we normally talk about Judeo-Christian values, starting with the media, academia, statements by politicians, and comments made in churches, synagogues, and other places, said Aga Saeed, founder of the and chairman of the American Muslim Alliance. Other groups supporting the change include the Council on American Islamic Relations, the Muslim American Society, and American Muslim Council. These are not just make you feel good words, said Dr. Saeed. These are words that define how we are related to each other. The movement to drop or change the phrase Judeo-Christian has non-Muslim support as well, including the head of the National Council of Churches. Well, there's no surprise there. The Reverend Bob Edgar, General Secretary for the Council, which represents 36 Christian denominations and falling, said he prefers Abrahamic to Judeo-Christian Islamic because it rolls off the tongue a little easier. The more inclusive we can be, he says, the more committed we are to the founding fathers and mothers who struggled with the issue of respect for each other's religious faiths. Dr. John Schmidt, a biblical scholar at Marquette University, says Judeo-Christian is disparaging to both Jews and Christians. He supports the movement to include Muslims. Others argue that the phrase Judeo-Christian is political correctness and revisionist history at worst. A lot of the ideas that underpin civil liberties come from Judeo-Christian theology, said there he goes, he just used it, the Reverend Ted Haggard of Colorado Springs. He's the president, the new president of the National Association of Evangelicals. What the Islamic community needs to make are positive contributions to the culture and society so that we can include them. So I guess Ted Haggard isn't against, in principle, changing it from Judeo-Christian Islamic, but he doesn't believe that the Islamic community has yet made sufficient contributions to our culture and our society to earn the label. Michael McCarty, Vice President of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, a Washington-based think tank, said that a Judeo-Christian understanding of things, like freedom of conscience and liberty, underlies the Constitution. No offense intended, he said, but Muslims weren't a part of that, even though they were part are part of the discussion now. Well, see, that's the whole point, isn't it? We're not talking about what America used to be. We're talking about what America is now. What do you think about this? Should we begin? Would you be surprised or offended or troubled to hear, say, President Bush stand up and say, America has always found its deepest underpinnings and foundations in the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition? Would that worry you? The phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Jerry's calling from South County. Jerry, welcome to Issues, etc.
Hi. You know what? I have sort of a problem with this word. The Catholics, the word Catholic means universal, I understand. But, you know, if you're going to have a church, a universal church, everyone should believe in the Trinity, you know, not their own God. Now, the thing is, in Assisi, Italy, in 1986, and I think since then even, the Pope John Paul II held the ecumenical gathering, and I'm sure you heard of it, and I think there were two of that I know of, and everyone was there, the Catholics, the Protestants, you know, any religion, any Christian, you know, group that is not Catholic, and the Muslims, the Hindus, the Buddhists, and he asked them all to pray to the saint, to God. Well, they're praying to their God, and I don't think Jesus was even among them, because that is idolatry or something in the form of, well, it's that the commandment of you should not have false gods before me. So for the Pope to say, let's all pray together, Jesus is not going to be there, just the, you know, pagan entities that they're praying to. So that word that the Catholic means universal, I don't think it should even be used.
Jerry, thank you very much for the call. Okay, now she points out several things that need to be highlighted. First of all, yes, the term Catholic does mean, what it means, the word universal can be deceiving too. The best way I've come to understand the term Catholic in its right sense is the same everywhere, at every time, with everyone. Now, another way of saying that is universal. But sometimes when Christians hear the term universal, they hear universalist, which is very different. When the creeds say, we believe in one holy Catholic and apostolic church, that's the way the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed articulates it. When Christians used to use the term Catholic, they meant the same everywhere, at every time, with everyone. The term they used was Catholic. And the other thing she points out is absolutely right. That is, if it's the Pope or anybody that gets people of different religions together to pray and say, let's all pray to God, they are not praying to the same God. And it is simple. It doesn't take a genius to figure it out. It is as simple as the first commandment. Dennis is calling from his car. Dennis, welcome to Issues, etc.
Hello, Pastor Todd. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing well.
I wanted to make a comment about the individual from the Muslim society or the association. I think you know, his statement is intellectually dishonest and it's academically deceiving. Within the text of the Quran itself, Jews and Christians are definitely execrated. They're stated as being enemies of Islam, that they're not to be trusted. This is in numerous passages and numerous surahs. Also, when he says that they're following the tradition of Abraham, in Islamic teachings and in the Quran itself, Ishmael is considered the number one son and not Isaac, and not from the house of Jacob. So if you want to talk about that.
Absolutely, Dennis. Thank you very much. Two good points. The second one first. It is said, this is one of the arguments, there are four arguments for put forth in this article that I have been sharing with you for referring to America as a Judeo-Christian Islamic nation. One is the numbers of Muslims. It's growing in the United States. No one denies this, although it is still very small. But it will quickly surpass the number of Jews in the United States. Commonality, that's the second argument. The other two are diplomacy. It's just a good way of smoothing things over since September 11th, and history, which is the fact that, of course, many black Americans who came to the United States or were brought to the United States in the era of slavery were Muslims. Islam has a long history in our country. There's no two ways about it. But commonality is the argument that Dennis is addressing, and that is, it's commonly said, well, at the very least, don't Christians, Jews, and Muslims share Abraham? Don't they have him in common? The answer to that question is yes and no. Yes, in only this limited sense. All three claim to be traced back to certain promises made to Abraham. Christianity actually makes an additional claim, and that is to go back past Abraham all the way to God himself in the Garden of Eden, to the first gospel, that the seed of the woman would crush the serpent's head, referring, of course, to Jesus Christ. But that's all the farther the commonality goes between the three, in that in some general sense they trace themselves back to some promise made to Abraham. The problem is, you can't even get a commonality there between Christianity and Jews. Because Jews will tell you that promise extended to national Israel, period. Actually, there's some Christians who will tell you that too, sad to say. Whereas Paul seems to say in the New Testament that that promise made to Abraham does not refer to national Israel. Not in the past, not in the future, not at 1948, not now, but refers to and is fulfilled in Jesus Christ. I think he says something about this in those crazy books, Romans and Galatians. Read them sometime. Not to mention the Muslims who say, well, the promises, whatever they may have been, weren't really for Isaac down through Jesus Christ, but Ishmael down to us. This isn't commonality, not even in Abraham. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. It's Open Lines, Issues, etc. When we come back, 25 more minutes of Open Lines for your questions, your comments. Do you think that America should be referred to as a Judeo-Christian nation the way it has been for half a century? Or is it time to change that and make it Judeo-Christian Islamic? Stay with us.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.